How do the best data scientists in the world master their datasets, train their machine learning models, and climb the data science ladder? Let's ask them. My name's Jeremy, and this is the Towards Data Science podcast.
What institution you're coming from, you can get access to the very latest research.
We also have to make sure that we're constantly revisiting our foundations and justifying why we're using the methods we are.
It's hard not to employ. Like, it doesn't matter what field you're in or what is it that you're good at. If you're good at something, if you like something with passion, there is someone who really, really needs you.
Bam! Lucky you. You're listening to the Towards Data Science podcast, a totally carb-free, high-fiber home for some of what we hope are the most interesting conversations about data science on the entire internet. We are on episode 7 of our Climbing the Data Science Ladder series, and if you've been following the series so far, you probably know that my name's Jeremy, and that apart from hosting the podcast, of course, I'm also part of the team over at the Sharpest Minds Data Science Mentorship Program. I'm really excited about today. Because today, I get to talk to Serkan Piantino. Serkan spent 8 years at Facebook, including several years he spent as the director of engineering at FAIR, which is Facebook AI Research. If you're familiar with machine learning, you're familiar with deep learning, you definitely know who these folks are. Obviously, a world-class center for AI research. You've probably even read some of their, or you might have read some of their deep learning papers as well. So he's really seen world-class AI research, but he's also seen applications of machine learning, sort of more practical applications of machine learning in industry. So he's got some interesting perspectives to share there. If that wasn't enough, though, he's also founded a company called Spell that's built a platform for end-to-end machine learning. Basically, they make it really easy for you to do stuff like train your model on GPUs from a Jupyter notebook, for instance. So there's some infrastructure knowledge that he's got there that he's going to share with us. He's also going to talk to us about research and industry and all the stuff he learned at Facebook. So I think it's fair to say we've got a lot of ground to cover today. So let's just dive into it. Serkan, thanks so much for joining the podcast.
Yeah, pleasure to be here.
You've got a lot of interesting facets to your biography here. I want to make sure that we get the chance to focus on everything that's particularly interesting. But can you walk us through your journey all the way from like when you did your undergrad in CS and math all the way to, you know, working at Facebook and ultimately what you're doing now over at Spell?
Yeah, no, happy to. As you mentioned, I did an undergrad at Carnegie Mellon. CS and math was my major. And right out of college, I did a brief stint in finance and I worked at a hedge fund. Pretty noteworthy. I think it's the biggest hedge fund in the world. And it's called Bridgewater, and the founder is relatively famous. So I was at Bridgewater for a couple of years and then totally switched gears and joined Facebook in 2007. And my first job was building a lot of infrastructure, particularly the newsfeed infrastructure, and designing a lot of our ranking algorithms for figuring out what to show you in newsfeed. And so I managed that team for a couple of years. I moved back to New York in 2010 and started the Facebook office here, which we grew to about 1,400 people. And then in 2013, I co-founded our first research lab, Facebook AI Research, with Yann LeCun. And there, I was mostly interested in building the engineering team, providing some organizational structure, and most importantly, building the tools that we would use to make the researchers that worked there very efficient. And that was kind of a formative experience. I think, you know, one of my favorite things to do was to introduce our tools to new people that were joining the team. So if you were a researcher and you were in academia, you might have, you know, gotten a grant for a couple $1,000s and built a GPU rig that you kept under your desk. And, you know, you were able to run one or two experiments at a time. Those might take days or weeks to train if you're doing, you know, pretty cutting edge neural networks. And you're used to managing a lot of that infrastructure yourself. So you're installing drivers, you're like doing a lot of basic DevOps. So those people would join Facebook, and we had invested a lot into a very general purpose compute infrastructure. So with one command, you could run not just one experiment or five experiments, but you could run a whole frontier of experiments. And so watching people's mentality shift from, you know, starting with a calendar and figuring out what experiments they could do in the resources that they had to, you know, running an experiment or trying something the minute they think about it. That was kind of one of the most eye-opening things.
The sort of shift from the scarcity mindset to the abundance mindset?
Exactly. And I think there's this thing that happens with tools. I think I really love building tools because, you know, it's often one of the most leveraged things that you can work on. Mm-hmm. I think organizations usually undervalue how much working on tools is going to accelerate them for the life of the company. But also there's this sort of mental shift when you go from like the mental burden of think about like Amazon, right? If you're like, okay, well, I want this thing. Well, I can go then like, you know, find the website and I can spend all this time filling out my address information and I can pay the shipping, you know, just the like reducing that cost to low enough where I don't even think about it. I just like, you know, one click, press a button. That turns out to be really powerful. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think was happening with those researchers. When you go from, I can create this experiment, I know how to build the infrastructure, I can like figure out how to get, you know, a GPU in the cloud or something, to as soon as I think about it, you know, I'm running the command to do it,
yeah,
and looking at results. That like reducing cognitive load to zero thing is just so powerful and delightful. I really like doing that.
Well, one thing I find really fascinating in that kind of philosophy too is it applies, I think, at the individual level as well. Like when you are a data scientist working in a company, if you find yourself reusing the same code over and over, or you know, you find yourself consistently rebuilding the wheel, reinventing the wheel, like, you know, that's a great indication. You need to build a library. You need to invest in your tooling. Is this something that you found yourself doing, like as a practitioner, like as a machine learning engineer?
Oh, of course, 100%. I mean, like building, you know, having your own little script here that does, you know, one thing or another, or even, you know, I found that I started inventing file formats. You know, I would take, I would figure out some way to store data that made sense to me, and then, you know, there's a lot of different data set file formats out there. So probably inventing another one wasn't the most efficient use of my time. But you always have your environment customized to what you need. And you're always, I think, if you have any sort of inclination towards software, you're always trying to script out things that you can use in the future.
Here's kind of a practical question, because I think a lot of people, you know, listening to this, they're thinking, you know, okay, this guy worked at Facebook, he obviously, and now you work in machine learning infrastructure, like professionally with your company. Like you obviously have the process down. And maybe this is an unanswerable question, but what amount of time would you say went into investing in tooling versus actually like solving data science problems on a day-to-day?
Yeah, I mean, the traditional answer to this question is, for anyone who's a software engineer, they spend 80% of their time doing things that aren't just, you know, writing new things in code. And I would say in data science, machine learning, that number is probably closer to 96%. Just from, you know, writing to parse TensorFlow logs so you can, and then, you know, getting a time series of loss just to chart the results of your experiment. I mean, even something like that is like a very common task in machine learning. So yeah, it's super inefficient. It's super early. A lot of the tools that we use come out of the research world, and they just don't have the ergonomics. They don't have the sort of like full featuredness that, I guess one way I put this is, if you think about traditional software engineering, so you're writing imperative code to tell a computer what to do. We started doing that, what, in the 50s, arguably, 60s or 70s, maybe. And we've had a long time to make the process better and more efficient. And it's still not that efficient, but we have IDEs. We can autocomplete, you know, half of the stuff that you're writing. So that's gotten really good. Machine learning kind of been around for a while, but it's kind of hitting mainstream and it's changing and it's becoming more powerful. And we're about to start that process with this other way of writing code where, you know, you teach an algorithm by showing it examples. And that has different, you know, can borrow some of the things from traditional software engineering, but it is different and it requires different tools. And I think that open field and this desire to, you know, I always tell my team, we're in the making things easy business. the desire to help people and make things easier, you know, is really what drew me to start Spell.
It really seems like the software engineering side of data science is, yeah, based on what your description so far, it seems like that's the big differentiator between the research world and then the world of production. And obviously, right, you've dealt with both intimately. I mean, leading these research teams at Facebook and then actually focusing on the production side at Spell. Are there other things besides just like the software engineering, the general making things easier, that are different between those two worlds?
Yeah, I mean, for a long time, moving something to production meant rewriting it in C++. And I'm glad that that's less the case these days. So always this sort of like pipe dream, we're going to use the same tools in research that we're going to use in production. And a lot of people tried that, and a lot of people didn't get very far. But now that's kind of, you know, where you're at. You write a lot of pretty sophisticated, high throughput services we see are Python on the back end, you know, running PyTorch or TensorFlow serving. So so that's finally, I think, starting to happen. I mean, I think the other thing I would say is, surprised how often, you know, for a lot of time working in a research group and not having a PhD, no matter how senior you are, is like, you know, you get a little imposter syndrome. There's, yep, like, I remember my favorite is, I kept going to these, you know, we'd have people come in and give talks on their research, and I would be really intimidated by the fact that, like, you know, half of the things they're talking about, I didn't really understand. And I talked to Rob Fergus, who has, you know, sort of worked with Jan for a long time as another leader at FAIR. And I was like, you know, Rob, I usually understand about 50% of what's going on in these, you know, in these presentations. And he's like, oh yeah, we all understand only 50%. That's what happens in research. You know, everybody knows, yeah, their one really well. So that really helped. But what I find, point is, what I find in is that it's usually just a talented engineer who's like started tinkering with PyTorch and was like, found some code online. You rarely, you know, startups or even larger companies, they rarely can afford to go and buy the type of research talent, or they rarely need to, because,
yeah,
you know, the application budget doesn't require that you march out to the frontier of what's possible. So, I mean, one of our big theses is that, you know, it really is becoming part of software engineering. Machine learning is just another tool that software engineers use. And that's why we think of ourselves as a developer tools company, more than we're powering research or, you know, a thing specific to data scientists or any of those things.
So that's a really interesting point. This theme's come up a lot on the podcast already with the last couple of guests. We talked to Joel Gruss, who you may or may not be familiar with, but basically he's a big kind of advocate for using software engineering best practices in machine learning. Both for, you know, all the sort of replicability reasons and also just for ease of use.
Yeah.
And I think this is something that it's starting to dawn on some people that data science really is becoming more and more like software engineering. Do you see the roles like continuing to merge until we literally don't have data scientists anymore, or are things going to change in some different way?
I don't think you ever don't need a data scientist, because I think like anything with software engineering, so, you know, let's say you use a database product, there's a certain scale, or there's a certain, you know, when your demands get to a certain point, you need to know how databases work, you know,
yeah,
or you wouldn't even want to write your own database. And I think even if you're not, you know, writing your own version of Postgres, like it's helpful to know under the hood what it's doing. I think computer science is a lot of picking layers of abstraction and using the one that's most useful and most appropriate, but knowing the layers beneath. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a point at which you really do want to know the exact math behind some analysis you're doing. But I think there's just, you know, there's like an 80-20 rule where 80% of the value you can get not really knowing under the hood how this particular implementation works, particularly with deep learning, I think, because a lot of what deep learning is trying to do is mimic a very like natural intuitive thing that a human already knows how to do. So you have more intuition around if it's doing it correctly or not, versus if you're trying to use PCA to understand a larger data set, probably need to know what PCA is designed for and what it can and can't tell you. So, I don't think data science is not going to exist, but I think this sort of way advances in machine learning become really impactful on society and on industry, then becoming part of the tool set that everybody that's already writing software.
Yeah. And so if you're either breaking into the field today or you were, you know, trying to focus on your skill development as a machine learning engineer, as a data scientist, would you focus on the software engineering side? Like, would that be the focus for you at this point?
On the best practices that surround making use of what's already out there. I would do a lot of, you know, I would basically take the shortest path I could find through as many different styles and types of applied machine learning projects. You know, I would build a GPT-2 model and have it write my emails for a week, or I would, you know, I had a friend who was using Spell to, he had a camera above his door and he wanted to know when the UPS came. So he built a computer vision model based on those things. I mean, that is super valuable and is honestly a lot of times what companies are looking for.
Yeah.
You know, particularly startups, they just want to see that you've done something successful with these tools. They don't necessarily need you to be a, you know, tenured faculty at Harvard.
Yeah. So focus on like implementation, easy to understand projects that deliver on a clear value proposition. Fair to say?
Exactly. And I would say also get used to looking at and being curious about data.
Mm.
I think just like, you know, caring about like, how is this data collected? Where's the line of code that logs this, you know, to this log file that I'm seeing elsewhere? What do these fields mean? There's nothing is going to work if you don't, you know, care about the quality and the substance of your data.
That makes a lot of sense. It's certainly something that we tend to see with the folks that we work with as well as, you know, trying to break into the field. That focus, yeah, makes a lot of sense. I want to pivot the conversation in a direction that's going to seem slightly orthogonal to what we've been talking about so far, but that I think is actually quite related. And it's related in for a reason that you brought up before we started recording this chat. So you said that one of the reasons that that focusing on process and replicability is really important is the ethics of AI, bias in AI, being able to detect those effects. And yeah. I think this is really one of the unsung heroes of the kind of software first approach, the make it easy approach, is the fact that it lowers the activation energy to discover things like, oh, I've got this massive bias in my data set or whatever else. Can you speak a little bit to that? Like, what's your view on the overlap between the ethics and the ease of implementation side?
Yeah, I completely agree. As I say all the time, we're in the make it easy business. And I think what you find is that in order to use AI responsibly, you have a couple extra steps you have to go through. This is my, you know, basic framework. And those involve checking for bias. Those involve understanding your data, things like that. I have a story that really kind of captures this. So early on at Facebook, I worked with somebody that had come over from Google. And, you know, they'd worked on this project where Google has a whole humongous number of resumes. They have, I think, you know, actual copies of a million resumes or something like that. And then they have, they also have records that tie those resumes to who was granted interviews to work at Google, how they did on those interviews, if they got jobs and accepted them. They even had how well did they perform at Google? Did they get promotions? Did they, you know, get positive performance reviews? That type of thing. So this is an amazing data set. And at the time, you know, NLP techniques were relatively, you know, a lot since then. So they ran this resume text through a classifier and they tried to figure out if they could predict, you know, which resume was worth interviewing. And the results looked good. It was very predictive. So they looked at their model and they asked it, well, what's the most negative indicator on a resume? And they found things related to professional accreditation. Like if you're a Microsoft certified architect or—
I could see that, yeah.
That's like super negative. That means you're not gonna get a job at Google. On the positive side, the number one thing that indicated you were gonna get a job at Google was being named David. So I like that story because it shows it's a good way of explaining to somebody how machine learning is not, it doesn't have the common sense to discard, you know, a thesis that a human would never really, and that can be dangerous. And it's also a happy story because in this particular case, they didn't just march that model into production. They took a look at it and saw that it had some issues and then went back. Yeah. And I don't think Google actually does use machine learning to grade resumes, probably because they're aware of the ethics surrounding this issue. But if they do, I'm sure they've like thought about this problem. But these days with, you know, it's harder as machine learning models get more and more sophisticated, it's harder to ask those kinds of questions.
Yeah.
And so to your point, when you have more structure, you know what data a model was trained on, or you know the model's in a certain format, or you know the model's of a certain type, you can make asking those questions easy and the default next step after training a model. And that can have a real positive impact on how many times something unfortunate like the David detector ends up getting used in the real world to make real decisions.
Which also is like, you know, textbook overfitting. So it, like, you know, there's a sense in which this is like a basic sanity check that everybody should be running, but there's so many ways, especially in NLP, to overfit that, like, you know, your space is so high dimensional. It's like, you just have to do exactly what you're describing.
Yeah. And I mean, it can be, you know, a lot of times I used to call this sleight of hand, and it is sort of sneaky. Like you find a technique and you look at the paper and you see all these amazing examples. I mean, this is rampant in GANs. You see these like wonderful examples of everything working out particularly. And then you pick some other point in the latent space and you get some sort of alien artifact. So I think it can be hard to figure out, the more hard it is to figure out where it's giving you complete nonsense. So I have some empathy.
Or even how to know, like, you know, what it, like, how should I decide that this GAN is actually good, even if the vast majority of points in the latent space are useless? Like, maybe I don't need the vast majority of points to be useful. Maybe, you know, the handful of times. Interesting. Okay, so well, one maybe more petty question to ask, because you brought it up in that example. You talked about certifications being one of the big tells that like a resume was not going to make it through. I'll admit I have a big bias on this one. I really strongly agree with that, and I'm not sure why. Do you have any sense of why like listing certifications is linked to that?
You know, I think probably, I think it's probably somewhat biased, to be honest with you. I think like people who choose to get certified in certain technologies are probably, I would imagine that like Google is one of the first companies that was hiring people with the idea, and Carnegie Mellon is like really, their curriculum is based on this idea that there are just underlying concepts in computer science, and you don't go out and learn how to be a Java developer or a, you know, SQL developer or a Python developer. You just learn how software is written, and then you learn the elements of different languages on the side. And I think if you're getting a certification, you probably have not invested in that type of generalism, and that's what Google's looking for. So I think that might be part of it.
That's interesting. Yeah. I guess I was sort of thinking maybe it's along the same lines. I'm still not sure if they're the same explanation. I was sort of thinking, you know, what's the kind of person that feels compelled to get an IBM certification on topic X, rather than maybe just being more intrinsically driven by the tech, say, or the math behind it. I mean, I don't really feel strongly about this, but I do think there's a sense in which, you know, you kind of become one among a sea of people who all have these certifications too. Like the certifications themselves are so common. It sort of serves to flag you as a median applicant, as an average applicant.
Yeah, I mean, you see that and I see that, but people get bad career advice all the time, you know?
Yeah.
So I think there's a little bit of bias in that where, you know, there's a little bit of, not a lot of early people at Google had done that. So I don't know, some of it, some of it makes sense and some of it doesn't. But I have empathy for people that think like, well, I need a job in the software industry. Microsoft tells me this is the path to do it. So,
yeah, it is Microsoft after all. Yeah, makes sense. So, okay, this links actually to kind of a related question, which is, you know, people often talk about how there's a lot of gatekeeping at big tech companies. You know, Facebook surely included all the FAANG companies. So I guess the question here is, okay, number one, do you agree with that notion as somebody who's on the inside and would have had access to some of the hiring practices? And if you do agree with it, you know, what would you recommend candidates do if they're trying to break in? And if you don't agree with it, what's the source of that disconnect between perception and then the internal reality?
Oh man, yeah, this is a good one. So I think I definitely think there is gatekeeping, or the way I like to think it, kind of a unjustified bias toward hiring from, let's call it a certain set of schools, or, you know, people that have worked at a certain set of companies, and not a lot of, you know, it's hard to, not a lot of consideration of people with a more non-traditional backgrounds. And I think that is, I think it's hard, you know, especially running a startup, like going out and, you know, the playbook is there, figuring out where the playbook is wrong and trying to break out of it is something that takes a lot of energy. Now, it's also very valuable, I think. And, you know, the job of a founder is to mostly recruiting. And so it's something we spend a lot of time on. I would say the other thing is that a lot of recruiting at any of these large companies, the actual people doing it are just kind of like volunteer borrowed labor from the engineering team, right? Mm-hmm. And so the tendency is for them to be kind of lazy and check boxes. And the more you're checking boxes, the less you're being thoughtful and open-minded, the more you're, the less you're like engaging with a candidate and trying to figure out where their strengths are. And the more you're throwing the question up on a whiteboard and, you know, spotting bugs in their code, the more that becomes a, like you said, a gatekeeping process. So let's see. My advice would be, the good news is like, the more they standardize these interviews, the more you can kind of just Google a set of the questions that they ask and you can study. Mm-hmm. My first job interview after college was with Microsoft, and I bought the How to Move Mount Fuji book, which is like all about how Microsoft does interviews, and I didn't read it. And I went into the interview and I told the interviewer that I had bought the book but hadn't read it. And he was like, you should have read the book. And that was the end of my interview. So I thought the strategy was like, don't learn to the test. You know, you want to show that you're versatile or whatever. And it's like, no, learn to the test. This is what they're going to ask you. You should probably, you know, be prepared for it. So that's what I would say there. And I think the best way, you know, I did a lot of recruiting at Facebook. There were, having built something cool that other people at the company respect was always the number one way that we found people that, you know, didn't go to college, but ended up, you know, pretty fantastic employees. So you can always get attention by building something cool. There was one, I was on Reddit a long time ago, and I found someone who had built a zip file Quine. So they had taken some like animated GIF that they thought was funny, and they had engineered a zip file where when you unzip the file, you got the original zip file plus that animated GIF, which is not easy to do. And so I ended up tracking that person down, ended up being a software engineer in Norway, and we hired him and he was fantastic. So like little things like that do work, but yeah.
So in our very latest podcast, we had on a guy called Jay Fang, who he went into data science working at a company that got acquired by Monster. And his story was actually really had some interesting overlap here. He was saying he focused on building a data science brand by publishing blog posts on interesting topics. And anyway, it seems like there's a lot of cool overlap here where it's like these, as you say, it's easy to understand projects that people are impressed by. That's like the ultimate way in.
Absolutely. Also, like writing, one thing I see a lot is there's a lot of companies doing content marketing, and then there are people who are writing explanatory content. I think quality matters a lot. If you are truly explaining, if you're, you know, truly, you know, helping somebody get their head around a new topic, that's very different than like, here's a sequence of steps I ran, here's some commands, and this is what I got.
Yeah, the shift enter mindset.
Shift enter, yeah, exactly. Yeah, just like tossing a Jupyter notebook onto Medium isn't probably as valuable as like, here's an actual, you know, thoughtfully written piece. We have this thing here, JD, who's runs our marketing team, says is like three for you, one for me. So like, out of fourth, you know, whatever we publish, three of them will be solely designed, to help the audience either understand a new topic or you know, link to a demo where they can get a more interactive experience with something that just came out, or even just like cool data. You know, Gartner says that these are the top AI priorities for 2019. So, and then one of those things will be something that's either promotional or gets the word out about our product or something. And I would say it doesn't need to be a demonstration of what you did. It needs to be something that could be truly valuable to somebody else. And because there's a lot of the former and not enough of the latter.
I think there's also the flip side too, which is the consumption of the information itself. Like there are a lot of, you know, shift enter type blog posts and videos online where, you know, you can sit through them and they'll tell you like, we'll explain to you like how GANs work in 5 minutes, and you complete the video and you have like that feeling, that illusion that you've just understood something. But I think it's, I think it was, I was reading Eliezer Yudkowsky had some blog post on Less Wrong where he talks about just this idea of noticing that you are confused and realizing that actually, you know, I've watched this 5 minute video. I may have a superficial sense of how this works, but like, can I actually go clack away at a keyboard and make it happen? Like probably not. And that sort of content, it's like, it's almost, you're almost worse off for having consumed it because of what it does to your illusion of understanding.
Oh, totally. That's really interesting, because I've noticed that, you know, outside of software engineering, when I'm trying to learn, like I just got a ham radio license, which is like the pretty nerdy hobby, but I've been watching a lot of YouTube videos, like learning about it. And one thing I noticed is I'll watch 10% of one video and then move on to another video. And I think the point is the video format doesn't allow you to stop and debug something in the process. Yeah. Just watch it start to finish. And if you're not debugging your understanding, then you're accepting everything at face value. You're not really building an understanding. You're just like, you know, kind of accepting what's there. So I totally agree. There's any, you know, curriculum, I find, you know, we have a lot of people that do fast.ai. We have a lot of people who are doing Kaggle competitions or working through Coursera courses. I would say if you are doing a shift enter blog post, publish a data set and a task, because having access to that editor, being able to actually run something, that's huge.
It's almost the adversarial part of the generative adversarial learning.
Right.
Like you got to make contact with reality at some point, or you're just talking about theory. Cool. Well, so maybe we can take this in a kind of closing direction here. I want to learn a little bit more about what you're doing right now and how that ties into the direction you see the field evolving in the next, say, 5 years. So I'll throw you a kind of an open-ended question, and I'm sure this will tie into your company and the strategy. But so what do you think is going to be unrecognizable about machine learning 5 years from now that most people don't see coming?
Well, I mean, the easy answer is, what do they say? It's only AI until it's easy.
Right.
So I there are a lot of different ways of explaining, and I hesitate to use the term AI in exchange for machine learning, but a lot of different ways of explaining what that means to people. And I think one really useful one is that people's expectations of how they interact with technology are constantly marching on. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, part of the reason that I think software engineers are going to be doing machine learning as just a part of their usual day-to-day job in 5 years is that I think it's easier and it's, you know, there's a lot more data in the world, et cetera. But part of the reason I think that's the case is that it's going to be really hard to build anything that gets any attention or wins in any marketplace if it isn't human or magical in some way. And in order to do that, you know, our best techniques for doing that involve machine learning right now. Mm. So, you know, we think about if everybody's going to be doing machine learning, that is already writing code. One thing they're definitely going to need is a way of disconnecting the interfaces they use, the places they're writing code and that are built for that from the places they're running code. And it, you know, I think about it's like kind of a coincidence that as a software engineer, you've generally been able to just buy a pretty powerful laptop and write some code and then either compile your iOS app and emulate it or, you know, just like it turns out that we've been able to do this for a while, but I think that era is coming to an end. So we think about like a software engineer being able to write code, but also having to become this sort of like on the fly orchestrator of data and code and, you know, previous experimental results. And, you know, all these things need to be at somebody's fingertips.
So the client server dichotomy is going to become more and more important. The division between the two is going to become more and more stark as like I can do less and less on my client. I need to outsource compute to the cloud more and more.
Yeah. And if you think about it, that's actually, you know, to the point about where software engineering started, that's kind of what it was like in the 70s. You know, yeah. You'd have a terminal, but you actually shared compute resources with a whole bunch of other people. And not only did, you know, not only was that a necessity because you needed those compute resources, but it also was the kind of ecosystem in which Unix was developed and things like email and, you know, like time sharing and sharing files, like that world was a collaborative world. And my hope is that, you know, there's a version of that in machine learning that gets created over the next 5 years. That's our vision for Spell, obviously. But, you know, we want, as software engineers are constantly, you know, lifting up 100 gigabytes of data over here and mashing it into code that lives over here on a GPU that lives over there. You know, the fact that they're all using something together also creates more of a community and more collaboration.
Well, and I guess it's a tired like sci-fi trope that gradually we're moving towards a single kind of unified world of compute. And I feel like, I mean, it's a tired trope because it's obviously true. And this is obviously a big step in that direction. Awesome. Well, thanks so much for making the time for the chat. Did you have anything you wanted to plug, by the way? Obviously, Spell is a big thing, but are you on Twitter or?
You know what I want to plug is that, you know, for a lot of the people in your audience that, you know, if you're looking to use some curriculum that's online, you want to reproduce something you read on TDS, you want to do the Fast AI courses, you're working on Kaggle, that's exactly what we designed Spell for. It's free. If you want to use just CPU resources, it's completely free. And if you want to run experiments on a GPU, it's super easy. And we just charge you at cost for whatever cloud resources you use. So we really did design it to be the easiest way to just get started with machine learning or deep learning, you know, possible. So I hope a lot of people give it a try.
Awesome. Well, we'll make sure we include a link to it as well. I mean, there's going to be obviously a link to you and your profile, but they'll be able to check out a direct link to Spell as well. Thanks so much for making the time, Sirkan. This is great.